Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, back in our home places of place. And anyway, we're transmitting across the internet. This is episode 309 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. We're flying just the two of us. No chance this evening. He seems to be having birthday festivities this weekend.
Yes, he's got birthday.
And so how are you?
I'm doing awesome. It's a very comfortable 99 degrees here.
That's not too shabby. It's not terribly different here, to be honest with you. Hey, remember to show your support and hitting the like and subscribe button. Let's see if this thing will work over here. Where is that stupid button? There it is. Hey, press like and subscribe. Will it show up on the screen? Whatever. It's not showing up. It's trying. Oh, there it goes. And it's going to make the little sounds. Cool. Leave a 5-star review. Press like, subscribe on YouTube if you can. And if you want to, go over to your favorite podcast app and either leave a review or subscribe. That would be great. And then you'll get the podcast delivered automagically, as it were. And if you're feeling super generous, head over to Patreon and you can support the podcast. And that would also be incredibly valued. Now, with all that said, what are we doing this episode?
We have an appellate decision from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals out of Denver. And that one's going to be quite interesting, I hope, I think. To me, it was very interesting. We have a case that's breaking news, just came in this morning. From Kentucky, and it's a district court decision dealing with PFR type issues. And I think you've indicated you want to talk about the Supreme Court's decision referred to as the Chevron deference. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah, that sounds like it could be a worthwhile conversation, kind of like an abstract ish, you know?
All right. And we have a letter from Robert, who's an insider. He asked a great question about plea agreements, and I know how much you love plea agreements. And then we received a submission from, I think, a practicing attorney on an issue you want to discuss about vehicle sales. And then we have Larry's General Rules.
Yeah, well, we're going to start with that one. So what is Larry's General Rule for episode 309 of Registry Matters?
Okay, this one, I don't know how much detail I'll have to go into, but I'll tell you the general rule, and then you can tell me if you need more detail. If you are employed as a police officer, I would say as a general rule, you should not file a false police report. But if you must file a false police report as an officer, don't file it with your own agency.
Couldn't we extend that just a hair and go, don't file a false police report, even if you're just a normal kind of citizen?
Well, yes. I don't encourage anyone to file a false police report, but there should be a little higher standard for officers who are wearing the uniform, have a badge, and have a certificate, law enforcement certification. You should not file a false police report, and certainly not with your own police agency.
And what are going to be the ramifications of said officer filing a bogus police report with his own department or his own office, whatever that is?
Well, in this particular instance, it was a rookie police officer in a small city here called Ruidoso. And he hadn't been on the force very long. And he did not report to work properly shaved. Command sent him home to clean up his face. And he did as he was instructed by command, but then as he was going to return to the station, he locked himself out of his apartment, and his body cam was inside his apartment. And he decided that going back to the station without a body camera after being sent home was probably not going to be the ideal circumstances. So he broke in his own apartment to get the body cam, and then he reported to his own police department that he discovered his door had been broken down.
Hold on. Like, that seems really insignificant. Why would he go through all that headache to break the door down? But couldn't you just call your boss and be like, whoops, I left my cam in the, and he also locked his keys in the apartment too?
Yes, he was having a bad day, it would appear. And I would say as a rookie officer, he was probably very frightened because being sent home was one thing. Then locking your keys in your apartment along with your body cam and reporting back to the station, he was looking pretty much like a doofus. So he had to think really fast about what to do. And at our age, he was a young guy, but at our age, I would have just fessed up and said, chief or whoever he's reporting to, I kind of goofed up. I locked myself out, and now I'm looking more goofier than I did to start with. But he broke the door, so now they've charged him with filing a false police report, which will ultimately lead to likely the revocation of his law enforcement certificate. So he won't have a future career in law enforcement. And this was all over something silly, and it's too bad that they would even charge him. I think just the embarrassment and the humiliation of what happened is enough punishment, but they've filed charges against him.
So don't file false police reports, especially if you're a police officer, especially in your own jurisdiction.
I would say that would be a solid rule to abide by, and I would like to think that as a part of the academy training, that one of the things that they would hopefully emphasize would be the way you would use an interrogation and getting people to tell you is like, don't file a false police report. I mean, you got to tell me the truth because we can hit you up with filing false stuff. You would think that he would know the consequences of filing a false police report. So
You
apparently
would think.
he didn't take it very seriously, and now he's facing those consequences.
Do you think that he would actually get prosecuted and beyond him essentially being fired and revoked from being a police officer, like, would he receive, is this a misdemeanor? Is this a felony?
I didn't look that up. It's likely a misdemeanor, but
Okay.
he's not facing any jail time as a first-time offender. But it's still a prosecution. He'll have a criminal
Of
history.
course. Okay, well, we received a letter from Robert, and he says on November 8th of 2002, or back to what you said, this is a person on the inside, so there's a handwritten letter that came in, and his name is Robert. Do you know where he is?
I do know. Yes. Don't remember though.
Is, oh, okay, well, it looks like he might be in Virginia. Does that sound
That
familiar?
sounds familiar, yes.
Very good, okay. So on November 8th, 2002, I pled guilty. In the plea agreement signed by the judge, I have indefinite supervised probation. A corrected copy of the court order was signed on 11, excuse me, on 123 of 2004. So that's just a year and a half later, by the judge without any mention of probation. The question is, does the court order supersede the plea agreement? And if so, does it mean I have no probation? That sounds like a good plan. Should I mention it to anybody, or after 20 years, can anybody go back and change the court order? The judge who signed the original court order is no longer there. And I hope you can answer this question.
Well, we can,
Okay. Okay.
and the answer is not usually going to be to his liking. A plea agreement is a binding contract between parties, the party being the defendant and the party being the state, in this case, the state of Virginia. And if that scenario were flipped over and they were adding conditions to him that was not a part of the plea agreement, and when I say conditions, I mean like additional time. If they were making his punishment more extreme, he would be irritated. What we don't know here, and I've asked for clarification, we don't know why they had to file an amended judgment and court order. But if it was not that, if they didn't renegotiate the plea agreement, if the original plea agreement was still the basis for the amended judgment that was filed 2 years, a year and a half later, he has nothing to stand on. That is a Scribner's error, and the state has the same rights he does to have what they bargained for enforced. So they absolutely could come back 20 years from now and they could correct what the plea bargain, what was agreed to by the parties, and they could change that. You better believe it. And they actually would do that. They've done that all throughout my legal career. I've seen that done many times. So it's not anything that's unprecedented. It's done with some regularity.
Let sleeping dogs lie, or what?
Well, he won't be able to do that. He's already writing everybody he could imagine. I'm sure we're not the first that he's written to. And for me to get the answer to him, the only way I can get the answer to him is to send it to the prison where the mail is scanned. Now, I know you don't have much of a sense of humor, but if I send him a copy of the transcript and they figure out that he's the one that this applies to, he's talking about himself, and they go reopen this and figure out that the judgment order is incomplete, that would be funny. Can you admit that?
No, because then the guy's screwed. How do you think, like, we just said a person's name and a state, and it's an incredibly common name. You think they would put that together?
Well, no,
I guess we gave dates.
If I send the transcript with the scanning of what they do, the only way I can answer him, otherwise he doesn't get the benefit of the answer. If I send him the transcript, and if they read the transcript, and if they figure out that he's the submitter of the question, it wouldn't be hard to put it together, would it?
No, especially if you send him his question back. But I was just thinking you'd send him the transcript.
Well, I would, but if they go into great detail looking at this transcript.
I can't imagine that they would do that, Larry. That's 20 pages or whatever, however big the transcript is. I can't imagine that they have that kind of time.
Well, lots of things you can't imagine happen, but it would be funny. At least admit that.
Okay, it's funny.
Yep. All right, let's move on.
And Brian asks, funny how, like a clown, I amuse you? I like that plan. So, what is this garbage you put in here about some late breaking news from Kentucky? Do we get to celebrate?
We do get to celebrate.
Oh, fantastic. All right. Well, this is a case of Joe Doe, not even John Doe, on behalf of himself. Oh, great. Pro se. And others similarly situated versus John Berlew in his official capacity as Davies County Attorney. This case is in the United States District Court for the Western District of Kentucky. Tell us and the Reader's Digest version. So, like, dumb it down and make it short.
All right. So during the 2024 legislative session, the Kentucky General Assembly passed and the governor signed into law Senate Bill 249. This challenge law is added to the PR4 registration statutes and provides in relevant part that a registrant who has committed a criminal offense against a victim who is a minor shall not create or have control of an account on a social media platform unless the account displays his or her full legal name. And the section shall apply retroactively, meaning that every PFR would be subject to this, and any person who violates this section shall be guilty of a Class A misdemeanor for the first offense and a Class D felony for the second and subsequent offense.
What did they claim? What did the Does make a claim against the Davies County Attorney, John Berlew? What did they make a claim against him?
Well, Doe asserted two claims under 42 United States Code, Section 1983, for violations of his constitutional rights under the First Amendment. In particular, Doe claims that the challenge law violates his right to speak anonymously and is unconstitutionally overbroad.
Larry, off script, isn't 1983 what Packingham was about?
What do you mean what Packingham was about? That's a vehicle. 1983 is a civil rights vehicle that you use.
It's a civil rights claim that ended up at the Supreme Court. I'd be willing to bet that if we looked up Packingham was a 1983 claim. So I see that Doe moved for a preliminary injunction and for class certification. Defendant Berlew opposed both motions and cross-moved for summary judgment. Doe moved for a temporary restraining order, which Berlew likewise opposed. I know how much you love summary judgment.
Well, it's different in this case because the defendant moved for summary judgment, not the plaintiff. This means that all assertions made by Doe are assumed to be true and that any doubt that the court may have goes to Doe, not the state, because he's the non-moving party. You know, you've heard me pontificate about this through all the years. So Doe didn't move for summary judgment. Berlew did. The state did. And therefore, everything Doe said is assumed true because we haven't had the benefit of a trial. So summary judgment isn't necessarily such a bad thing.
And now you're being Mr. Flip-Flop. Summary judgment is not always bad?
Not always bad. There's times when it's appropriate, but it's overly used by lazy attorneys. And attorneys that are listening, don't be lazy. Use summary judgment when there truly are no factual disputes and you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law, don't use summary judgment when you just are trying to be nice to the judge and clear the judge's calendar, and you're trying to clear your workload, and you don't have to do a couple weeks worth of trial prep. Use summary judgment when it's appropriate.
Did Doe oppose summary judgment?
Yes, he did.
A preliminary injunction was granted. I've heard you pontificate for years now about the difficulty of getting an injunction, which is what we did get. Didn't we get an injunction in Butts County?
We did.
Okay. What's the burden that must be met for getting an injunction?
Well, it's a tough one. The first and probably the most important factor is the likelihood of success. So this meant that Doe would have to show that he would likely prevail on the merits of his claims when this case eventually goes to trial. So you've got to show with existing case law, not you don't have to show that you don't like that the law, that you find it inconvenient. You have to show that there's enough in the body of case law out there that there's enough similar cases already been decided at appellate court level that suggest you're going to win on the merits. But the court must also consider whether Doe will suffer irreparable injury or harm absent the granting of the restraining order or preliminary injunction, and whether others will be substantially harmed by granting such relief, and whether the public interest would be served by granting the relief. But the most important test in my book is the irreparable harm and the likelihood of success on the merits. If you can't show that you're likely to succeed on the merits, and if you can't show that you're going to suffer irreparable harm, you don't get an injunction.
And does the fact that it's a First Amendment challenge play into this?
Indeed, it does. As the trial judge noted, the trial judge says the Supreme Court has held that when reviewing a motion for preliminary injunction, if it is found that a constitutional right has been threatened or impaired, a finding of irreparable injury is mandated. The judge found that those First Amendment rights are threatened and would be impaired by the enforcement of Kansas Revised Statute 17.544, and he has therefore shown irreparable injury to support his issuance of an injunction.
That's pretty awesome. And is this case being handled by a known attorney to us?
It is. It's being handled by Guy Hamilton Smith.
Fantastic. Well, congrats to Guy. Why didn't he tell us this at the that this case was being worked on at the conference?
Oh, he's reported on this case before. He just has there's so many cases going on. People don't always track with him. But yeah, this case has been going on for a few months now.
All right. Very good. Now, so we are going to dive into a real humdinger of a topic. Chevron deference. I got to tell you, man, when I first heard this term, like in the military, a chevron is just like a V-shaped kind of thing. And I'm like, chevron? What does that have to do with deference? Now, I reckon some of you might be scratching your heads, but stick with us and we'll unpack whether it's wise to let unelected bureaucrats call the shots on interpreting laws. First of all, tell us what Chevron deference actually means, please.
Well, I'll try. Chevron deference is a legal principle that courts use when reviewing decisions made by government agencies. It says if the law is unclear or ambiguous, courts should defer to the agency's interpretation of the law as long as the interpretation is reasonable. This means that agencies have the power to interpret and enforce laws in areas where they have expertise, and the courts generally won't second-guess their decisions.
Are you in favor of letting these various agencies do that kind of work?
Absolutely. It's the only way we can run a government in a civilized modern society.
Doesn't this come from a recent ruling regarding the EPA?
Yes, I didn't read the case, but yes, that's what I've heard talked about.
Okay. I can't disagree with you on the idea that wouldn't the EPA be better equipped to regulate our air and water than Congress?
But see, you're oversimplifying it. The EPA, the EPA is only doing what Congress told them to do. Congress just did not spell out all the details of what they would be doing. They didn't tell them to take the depth of the stream and how many fish it's got in it and all that kind of stuff to figure out if we've got an endangered species and all that kind of stuff. They said in broad terms what to do to accomplish the goals of the law. All the delegation has to fit within the statute. And people just, they create this scenario that people get to, that these agencies get to make up things. That's not the case. They have to work within the framework of the statute. So you don't get to invent the statute the way you'd like it to be.
Now, how do you go forth and justify that the delegation of significant interpretive power to unelected bureaucrats under Chevron deference, considering the potential erosion of democratic accountability?
Well, again, the Congress is not able to identify all of the nuances of what they want done. They just can't. And I always go back to something I think people understand, which is disability determinations. You can pick your agency, whether it be the Veterans Administration or the Social Security Administration. Congress defines what constitutes a disability. In the case of Social Security, they say you have to suffer a mental or a physical or a combination of the two impairments that have to be expected to last 12 months or longer and restrict you from engaging a substantial gainful activity, which they define, and it has to last 12 months or longer or it has to be something that will kill you. They directed the Social Security Administration to pay benefits based on that definition. Okay. Congress could never figure out what all the conditions would look like that would fall within that broad definition of disability. They just couldn't. Because even if you could, it's constantly changing. Disabilities mm-hmm. that were more disabling at one time through advances in medical technology, AIDS used to be an automatic ticket to disability. It doesn't do that anymore because we've learned how to manage AIDS and it's not as disabling as it was in the 80s. So you're not going to get a ticket to free benefits if you have AIDS nowadays. But Congress could never do that. But Social Security can only pay benefits if they can justify that the person has a significant mental or physical impairment that's expected to last 12 months or longer or result in death, and they have to meet the non-medical requirements of sufficient contributions into the system. If they paid benefits outside of that, there would be a legal action that could be mounted against them for disregarding the will of Congress. So they don't get to invent their own disability program. They get to effectuate the will of Congress in paying benefits to people that meet the definition of disability that Congress established. It's the same thing with the EPA. The EPA has been given a mandate with clean air and clean water and all these environmental things that they do. But if they go beyond that mandate, they can be reined in by judicial action. And this deference is only if it's an unreasonable interpretation. But if it's a reasonable interpretation, the agency's interpretation stands. And it would be the same thing with a disability determination. You can take your disagreement with Social Security to court if you choose to. If they deny you benefits, you can take it to the U.S. District Court. But in 95% of the cases that are taken to a federal judge about being denied disability benefits, the agency's determination prevails because the agency has medical staff. They have information that the Congress would never have had and that the court doesn't have. So the court's not going to say, well, I think I'm better determined to make it render a disability decision. They're going to back the Social Security Administration or the Veterans Administration in most of those cases. So that's what deference is all about. We couldn't run the government without it.
You don't think that it undermines the judiciary in interpreting the law independently?
No, because the judiciary can always do what they just did. If the judiciary finds that it's an unreasonable interpretation, the balancing factors are already in place. The judiciary can say this is an unreasonable interpretation of the statute. They can already do that.
Do you think that I'm assuming like when a new executive, so these agencies happen both at a state and federal level. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay, so the executive then appoints the leaders of the various agencies. Doesn't that create like a wishwash of how an agency would be run, making it difficult for there to be consistency and a stable legal interpretation of what the regulations would be from each new administration?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It could do that. It could, and it has. I go back to what I know and what I'm expert in. We had a president named Ronald Reagan. Are you familiar with that guy?
I've heard of him.
Yes.
Government's the problem.
Well, that president, when he took office, he decided his administration was going to be more aggressive with what they refer to as a CDI, Continuing Disability Review. And they reviewed and terminated somewhere between 5 and 700,000 people from the disability rolls because they felt that the administration of Social Security was being too lenient and too many people were freeloading. Congress struck back with a vengeance in 1984, and they suspended all disability reviews, and they tightened the requirements on the executive branch in terms of if a person was already determined to be disabled, that in order for them to terminate their benefits, they would have to show a new standard of medical improvement. Before that, you would basically have to reprove your disability when you got it notices of a CDI. They would start from scratch, even though you were already receiving benefits. But Congress said, no, that isn't right. They've already had a favorable decision, so you can only terminate them if medical evidence shows that, A, that the disability has improved, or through improved diagnostic techniques, that the disability is not as debilitating as we originally thought when the last favorable decision was made, or the favorable decision was based on fraud. Well, that changed the whole dynamic, and a whole lot of people didn't get cut off anymore, and a lot of those people that were cut off in the Reagan years were reinstated to benefits. There's a self-correcting mechanism in this. If the agency is being too aggressive under an executive branch, Congress ultimately can fix it. So I don't know what all the hoopla is about. I just don't. This just goes over my head every time this comes up.
How does this then, does this apply to our issue at all?
There are a lot of people that wish it did, and there's a lot of chatter of people that think it does. In my opinion, it does not. It will not change anything related to our issue, in my opinion. I think what the Attorney General did was consistent with the Congress action. When Congress delegated to the Department of Justice, they delegated for good reasons. They delegated because they already knew. Remember that. Let's put this in context. Adam Walsh Act passed in 2006.
Right.
When was Smith versus Doe decided?
01, I think, or 02?
03, I believe. Either 02 or 03. Okay. So then the challenger in Alaska, Doe, continued to litigate in state court. And I think by the time that this Adam Walsh Act was passed, I think he had already won in state court under the state constitution saying that that they could not apply it retroactively. So Congress was keenly aware that although it would like to have the more enhanced requirements of the Adam Walsh Act applied retroactively to everybody, they recognized that there would be potential constitutional problems from state to state. So they dealt with that in the best and the most efficient way that ever could be imagined. They put in a provision in the law that says that if a state cannot do what's requested of them to be substantially compliant, if the highest tribunal in the state says that they cannot comply for constitutional reasons, they will not forfeit their funding. That's put in there. And that should make conservatives enormously happy because the conservatives believe in states' rights, correct?
Yes.
They believe in delegating to the states. Well, that's precisely what was done here. The whole sex offender registry is delegated to the states. The states get to determine if they want to have one. They get to determine if they want to be federally substantially compliant. They get to determine if they want the federal funds or if they want to forego the federal funds. And the state gets to determine if it's constitutionally permissible. I can't think of a more solid conservative principle in my entire life than that. I just can't. And as far as delegating it, if you know that you've got constitutional problems from state to state, I can't think of a better way to delegate and who you would ask. Would you send it to the Agriculture Department to try to figure it out? Would you send it to the Department of Defense to try to figure it out? Would you send it to Homeland Security? Where else would you send it but to the Department of Justice? Where they supposedly can analyze the constitutions around the country, and they have highly paid legal professionals, and they would be able to make the determinations. And the Attorney General, like regardless of who it was Alberto Gonzalez, I think, at the time, but he determined that it would be applied retroactively. But that doesn't negate the fact that it still can't be applied retroactively if the courts in the state say, no, we won't let you apply that retroactively. So I don't know what the hoopla is about.
Someone said and then sent a link, Larry, and there's no possible way I have time for it, but I'm just going to read what was said. The problem with Chevron deference was the crazy fines and lack of access to courts. Chevron deference is fine as long as you can still challenge in courts.
Well, I don't know of any administrative process that doesn't allow you to go to court. I'm just not familiar with that. You always have the right. The judiciary is always open and doing business. But let me pose this question.
Sure.
Is there a single person out there that's registering anywhere in our vast audience? And I think we're approaching just shy of about 400,000 listeners now. Is there anybody out there that can show me that you're only registering because of federal law, that there's nothing in your state statutory scheme that says you have to register? And I believe you're going to come up empty-handed. You're going to be able to show me, at best, you're going to be able to show me that your state has an innocuous statute that says that you shall register if you're convicted of all these offenses, or if you would be defined as a defender under federal law. But if there is absolutely nothing in your state statute that requires you to register, you don't have to register. Sorry, folks, you're registering because of state law, not federal law. You're registering because of actions that your General Assembly has taken in your state. And if your state wants to abolish its registry tomorrow, they can do that. There's not a darn thing the federal government can do about it. Nothing.
Because back to states' rights.
That's right. And I can't think of anything that's more indicative of deferring to states than this. This is totally up to the states. If you have a registry, how thorough, how many people you register, how long you register them for. And I can tell you one thing else. All the things that you don't like about the Adam Walsh Act, most of those things are not even in the Adam Walsh Act. They're invented in your head to being the Adam Walsh Act, but they're not. The Adam Walsh Act doesn't control where you can work. It doesn't control where you can live. It doesn't control where you can be present. It doesn't recommend any of those things that are riddled in state laws. All these things are where you can't do. None of those things are in the Adam Walsh Act.
Do anything about residency or work restrictions?
None whatsoever.
Right?
None.
But it does create a database of sorts. Does that database require it to be publicly accessible?
Well, there are parts of the database that have to be publicly accessible to be substantially compliant. But again,
okay,
it's only if you want to be substantially compliant. You could do one or two things. You could tell the federal government, we're going to turn off every internet and link we have. We're not putting nothing available to the public. There's nothing the federal government can do about that. You could tell the federal government, we're not going to even have a registry. There's nothing they can do about it. You could tell the federal government that we're only going to register everybody for 10 years. You just wouldn't be substantially compliant. You wouldn't get your federal funds. But there's nothing they can do about it. And please, someone show me you're only registering because of federal law and there's no connection to your state whatsoever that covers you. I just don't think that such a person exists. Not even in Texas. People say, well, I'm registered because of federal law. I say, but yeah, because your state has interpreted that when you file your removal petition in Texas, they say, well, we've got a provision that says we can't remove you if you'd be defined as a sex offender under federal law. But you're not registered because of federal law. You're registered because of Texas, not because of federal law.
There was a huge thread on the affiliates list that after this came out, whatever, 2-3 weeks ago or something like that, that everyone was like palpitating that this was going to end the registry or something like that?
I've heard that and I don't understand it because I don't see it that way.
And then I think it was Guy, but I'm not positive that the way that he was reading it, saying that there's no ambiguity in it, or not no, but just very little that would be left to interpretation the way that the EPA would have updated guidelines as to what qualifies as parts per million of this and that in your water.
That is correct. There's very little ambiguity. The only ambiguity was in terms of the how to apply it retroactively. And they made a brilliant provision in there for what to do with retroactive applications. So if a state truly would like to apply it retroactively and their highest tribunal says they can't, you don't get dinged for that.
Very well.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. you can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
Well, let's move along then. Let's go to this Colorado county can be held liable for some naughtiness by a sheriff. Is that right?
Well, it was pretty naughty, I'll say that.
Yeah, okay. So this is from the 10th Circuit. It's Hollis Ann Whitson as guardian ad litem. What is ad litem?
Ad litem. I think that's a legal term in Latin for when you're not capable of representing yourself. So like a minor or incapacitated person, they'll have a guardian ad litem appointed by the court because that person being either too young or too incapacitated mentally, they need somebody to speak for them. So that's what a guardian ad litem does.
I see. Okay. And so this ad guardian ad litem for, oh my gosh, P-E-A-T-I-N-N-A, Piatina? Piatina?
Piatina Biggs, I think.
All right. Piatina Biggs versus the Board of County Commissioners of the County of Sedgwick et al. What's this case about?
Well, it has been alleged that Sheriff Thomas Hanna of Sedgwick County, Colorado, sexually assaulted an intellectually disabled prisoner while transferring her between county jails. The victim, Piatina Biggs, filed the civil rights under 42 United States Code 1983 and through her guardian ad litem, Plaintiff Hollis and Whitson against Sedgwick County.
The district court granted the motion of the county and the sheriff's department, the municipal defendants, to dismiss the complaint against them, reasoning that the county could be liable only if the challenged conduct had been taken pursuant to a policy adopted by the official or officials, and Hannah's action were not pursuant to department policies, but in direct contravention of them.
Yeah, I would hope so. That if those actions, if he took those actions, I would hope that they would be a direct contravention. Sheriff Hanna was then found liable by a jury in his individual capacity. Whitson appealed the dismissal of the claims against admissible defendants, which are legally equivalent to claims against Hanna in his official capacity. And this gets way over my head in terms of official and individual capacity, but we're going to muddle our way through it.
All right. Well, then the court stated, because the district court dismissed the claims against the municipal defendants on the ground that the complaint failed to state a claim against them, we assume the truth of the factual allegations of the complaint. On August 10th, 2016, Ms. Biggs was incarcerated in the Sedgwick County Jail. She is an adult with an intellectual disability. The jail was run by Sheriff Hanna, the highest-ranking law enforcement officer in Sedgwick County. Hanna told his deputy sheriff, Larry Neugebauer? Okay, well, anyway, N-E-U-G-E-B-A-U-E-R. The last part of that is definitely Bauer, but the Neugebauer. Anyway, so that guy, Sheriff Larry, so it's you, Sheriff Larry, that he was going to transfer Miss Biggs to the Logan County Jail using his personal vehicle. Hanna gave Miss Biggs her street clothes and ordered her to change into them. Deputy Larry knew it was highly unusual to have an inmate change into street clothes before being transferred. At about 12:15, he saw Sheriff Hanna load Miss Biggs, who was handcuffed, into the front passenger seat of his vehicle. That does sound strange, Larry.
Well, it does indeed, but it gets even stranger. The court stated, instead of transporting her to the Logan County Jail, Sheriff Hanna brought Miss Biggs to his home. With a gun in his holster, he offered to pay her $60 to have sex with him. She refused. He then sexually assaulted her. His gun remained visible on a coffee table throughout the assault. After the assault, Hanna threatened Ms. Biggs that if she told anyone about what he had done, she would spend the rest of her life in prison. At about 12:51, he told the dispatcher that he was taking Ms. Biggs to the Logan County Jail. After driving there, he deposited $20 into her commissary account. Apparently, he reduced the previous offer of compensation from 60 to 20. Now, can you at least admit that that's funny?
That's not funny.
Well, then why are you laughing?
It's not funny. It's just ridiculous. What was the naughty activity not worth $60? Did he have buyer's remorse, perhaps?
I've heard that happens when people pay for these services. I've heard that sometimes they don't think it was worth what they paid.
All right. While the assault was occurring, Deputy Larry drove past Sheriff Hanna's house on his way to and from his lunch break and saw Hanna's empty vehicle parked outside his home on both occasions. He reported the incident to the Logan County District Attorney's Office on August 22nd. Because of the threat by the sheriff, Miss Big had not reported the incident. The district attorney opened an investigation, and 2 days later, Hanna was criminally charged with sexual assault on an at-risk adult, sexual conduct in a correctional institution, soliciting prostitution, and first-degree official misconduct. Hanna was later removed as sheriff from office. This is really kind of out there, bizarre. I don't know why you picked this one to cover tonight, Larry, but whatever.
Well, because no one would believe this if we weren't reading this from the from the 10th Circuit. No one would believe. I mean, in all my 183 years now, I've never heard anything that is bizarre as this. But anyway, let's provide a little bit more background. Plaintiff Whitson filed a suit in U.S. District Court for the District of Colorado against multiple defendants, including the municipal defendants and Sheriff Hanna in his individual and official capacities. After the district court granted the municipal defendant's motion to dismiss, the claims against Hanna proceeded to trial. The jury rendered an $8.25 million verdict against him in compensatory and punitive damages. The problem is that the government was off the hook because the trial judge had dismissed them as defendants. The verdict was against Sheriff Hanna in his individual and official capacity, meaning that he had to pay it. And I doubt that most sheriffs have $8.25 million. So she needs the deep pocket. She needs the deep pockets of the government.
Nice. And so what you just said is that he's on the hook for the $8 million, not the government.
Right. Based on what the trial judge had decided by dismissing them, because this was not a sanctioned action. This was in controversy. What did he say? What word he said? This was controverted by the policy. He wasn't supposed to be doing this. So this was not an official action. So therefore, the county's not responsible. And so that's where we are so far.
I see. All right. Well, then Plaintiff Whitson moved to alter or amend the final judgment to explicitly bind the municipal defendants, pointing out that the judgment against Sheriff Hanna in his official capacity is a judgment against the municipal defendants. She cited Porro versus Barnes. Oh, my God. I'm not reading all these numbers. 624 Federal 3rd, 1322, 1328, 10th Circuit, 2010.
You did well.
Good grief. All right. And that is suing individual defendants in their official capacities under a 1983 claim. That's a constitutional claim. This is like the 1983 episode, Larry. Is essentially another way of pleading an action against the county or municipality they represent. This has to be considered official capacity. Has to be.
Correct. The municipal defendants, in turn, moved to clarify the judgment to say that the official capacity claims did not survive the motion to dismiss. The district court granted the municipal defendant's motion, concluding that Hanna's conduct could not be imputed to the municipality because, quote, the assault was wholly unrelated to the realm of his grant of authority with respect to transportation of prisoners, and he was advancing a purely personal agenda. Now, you've got to at least admit that. I don't think the policy of the county would have allowed for him to be doing what he was doing. So this was not an official act. Can you agree with that?
They wouldn't have sanctioned it, but him having the pistol there, or the whatever gun, whatever he had there on the counter, whatever, when the act was going on, along with he was transporting her between jails or prisons. Like, how is that not the most official act that you could perform?
Well, but people do bad things when they're on duty. I mean, I've heard of people crashing airplanes deliberately, and that's not an official action of the airline.
That's true. I don't think that those were airline pilots.
So, but they had to pay anyway, and that's where this is going. The county's ultimately going to pay.
Yeah, no doubt. All right. Well, then the court stated the central question before us is whether a final policymaker's assault of a county prisoner in the course of carrying out official duties for what he was charged with setting policy subjects the municipal defendants to liability. How did they answer that question?
They answered it, the 10th Circuit, yes. A municipal government is, wait a minute, they answered yes. A municipal government is not liable for every constitutional violation by one of its officers or employees. Rather, a municipality is responsible only for one, actions taken by subordinate employees in conformity with pre-existing official policies or customs, and two, actions taken by final policymakers whose conduct can be no less described as the official policy of the municipality. That's how they answered that. Now, that is about as clear as mud.
That I would have agreed with you if you had asked me if I understood that. The court noted that Sheriff Hanna was the final policymaker for the municipal defendants with respect to the care of county prisoners, including their transportation. By Colorado statute, the sheriff shall have charge and custody of the jails of the county and of the prisoners in the jails, and shall supervise them himself or herself or through a deputy or jailer. And that is Colorado Revised Statute annotated, section 30-10-511.
Good.
Okay. It is undisputed that the transportation of prisoners is within the realm of the county sheriff's policymaking authority. Hanna's actions with respect to prisoner Biggs were undoubtedly within the scope of activities for which he was set to policy.
And so she's winning right now. The court stated, and in this circumstances, we see no escape from the conclusion that Sheriff Hanna possessed final authority to establish municipal policy with respect to the action ordered. Indeed, he had not only the authority, but the responsibility to set policy with respect to treatment of prisoners in his custody. And that's on page 17. So he's screwed.
The court stated there remains the question of whether the municipal defendants are bound by the existing judgment against Hanna under the law of the case doctrine or preclusion principles. We leave it to the district court to determine in the first instance whether, and if so, to what extent, the municipal defendants are bound by the existing judgment. We do, however, make two observations that may be of some use. First, the judgment against Hanna include both compensatory and punitive damages, but the punitive damages are not recoverable against the municipal defendants. What is the law of the case doctrine?
Well, since I'm not allowed, according to some of the people here that listen, to say what the law says, I'm gonna read it from the Cornell Law School. The law of the case doctrine provides that an appellate court's determination of a legal issue binds both the trial court and the court on appeal in a subsequent retrial or appeal involving the same case and substantially the same facts. The appellate court's holdings on the questions presented to it on a review become the law of the case. The purpose of this doctrine is to promote finality and judicial economy by minimizing unnecessary relitigation of legal issues once they've been resolved by the appellate court. Cases such as this one from Indiana explain, I don't know where Indiana comes from, the law of the case doctrine precludes relitigation of all issues decided directly or by implication in a prior decision. However, the court notes where new facts are presented upon remand that materially affect the questions at issue, the court upon remand may apply the new facts and that are subsequently found. So this seems to say that unless there are new facts, my interpretation is that the law of the case doctrine may be a factor, but this is being sent back to the trial court for further development.
I noticed that in this, a judge dissented, Judge Phillips, he dissented. Is that relevant?
Oh, it definitely is. If I'm the state, I'd rely heavily on that dissent. Because ultimately, if the 10th Circuit forces Sedgwick County to be responsible for that $8 million judgment, you can hire a lot of lawyers for $8 million. And I would rely on that. And I would crank out a cert petition so fast in the Supreme Court. And I would say, in this beautifully written dissent, it's obvious that the majority of the three-judge panel got this wrong. So two of the judges are wrong. And this is very brilliant. That's exactly what I would do. And that's what they likely will do.
Judge Phillips stated, in my view, this is Judge Phillips speaking, not me. In my view, the district court got it right by concluding that the transportation of prisoners is within the realm of the county sheriff's policymaking authority. But the municipal defendants are not being sued because Mr. Hanna transported Miss Biggs. They are being sued because he sexually assaulted her. That is not within the policymaking authority of a county sheriff that a county sheriff has. He concluded the district court not err by concluding that Sheriff Hanna's actions were wholly outside his authority and lawful realm because he misused his power to advance a purely personal agenda.
And Judge Phillips is correct as well. And this is going to be a fascinating case for me to see how it ultimately resolves, because the county is very small populated, I think 2,500, 3,000 people, very small department. They don't have $8 billion. Unless they have an insurance fund, unless the Colorado Association of Counties or some similar entity is backing them, they don't have the money sitting around to pay this.
So does the county like cease to exist?
Well, I don't know how, what they pay would it? Do. I don't know what they would do. Like, say, there may be a risk pool in Colorado. The Mexico Association of Counties would become the backstop here for that. But if they don't have a similar setup there in Colorado, most counties of that size, they don't have $8 million just to write a check.
Yeah, totally. All right, we're going to go into a frustrating real-life scenario faced by someone dealing with the consequences of the registry. Larry, this situation is a perfect example of how the system can create unintended hardships. You ready to get into it?
I am. I think we're going to have a slight difference of opinion, but I'm ready to get into it.
So this is as the individual. So my husband and I have three cars. We bought two before he went in with the intention of selling number three. The number two has some issues, so we decided to sell it. Before he went in, he signed the bill of sale and the title so I could sell it. Both of our names are on the car registration. I was all set to sell the car today. Had a buyer lined up and everything. The question is, can I sell the car since it's registered as a car he drives on the registry? I think you have a short answer for that.
And if that's a question there, then absolutely, you can sell the car. Being on the registry has nothing to do with being allowed to sell or buy a car.
Okay. Well, then we will continue. I call the police department that handles registration. They say, I can sell it all I want, but it cannot be removed from the registry in any way whatsoever other than by him appearing in person, not by me with a bill of sale and transferred title, not by a notarized document signed by him and brought in by me, his wife, not by him signing a power of attorney, no way whatsoever other than him appearing in person, which is currently impossible due to the fact that he's living in a cage. They said I could sell it, but it'd still be on there, and he'd have to remove it when he gets out. Moving along. So if the buyer gets pulled over, it will pop on the registry, which I don't quite understand, but I understand the statement. If you get pulled over and they run the registration of it, and they run your license, and that's going to trigger the registry office to see that the car is listed with someone that's a PFR?
Well, see, this is an example of, hopefully I don't offend people, I usually do. This is an example of a person overthinking and creating a problem in their head that doesn't exist.
You mean like snowstorms in Lawton, Oklahoma?
This is even more creative than that. we're dealing with two different things. Your PFR registration and your vehicle registration are two entirely different things. You go to something that simulates your motor vehicle operation to register your vehicle. It's called DMV or MVD in our state, but you go to do your registration there. When you register as a PFR, you're giving them nothing more than just data about your vehicle. You're giving them possibly a photograph if they want it. You're giving them the license plate number that's assigned to the vehicle. And I don't even know if they capture the VIN, but they're going to capture your information, your registration. As we talked about in pre-show, the registration is plate to owner, meaning that when you sell the vehicle, that plate doesn't belong to the purchaser of the vehicle. It belongs to you. So that plate, say it has JPL567 as the numbers, that JPL567 would pop up to a registrant if an officer got behind it and they ran that. That would be in the system as assigned to connected to a sexual offender on the registry. But since that's not going to be the vehicle, that went with the seller. They kept that if they followed the process. The purchaser is going to have a brand new license plate that's going to have completely different numbers on it. So let me ask you this. How many times when you've been pulled over, have you seen an officer run your VIN?
I can't say that I ever have, but it's been a long time since I've been pulled over. But I don't think I ever remember the person like coming with a flashlight and looking in the little corner of the windshield to try and get the 25-digit thing, whatever it is.
Well, as technology has evolved, now they have these hand scanning devices. If you take your car to get the service done or to a body shop, or you know, say just scan it, and it clicks up on their screen the information about the car, the make, the model, and the stuff. They can do that. But I have not seen an officer scan a VIN when someone's pulled over. Now, with our vast audience, maybe someone has, but they're not going to connect that to the registrant. When the vehicle is sold, you're going to file a notice of cancellation of registration with your motor vehicle department. If you're not going to put that license plate on another vehicle, you're going to cancel the plate. And that ends the connection as far as I'm concerned. Unless they were to have some reason to run a VIN check in a normal traffic stop. They don't normally run VIN checks in a normal traffic stop because that's not what they're looking for, unless they have a reason to run the VIN. But let's say they do run the VIN. They come up with their handheld scanner and they run the VIN. The worst thing's going to happen is you're going to say, this car is connected to a PFR. Were you aware of that? And the person's going to say, what? Yeah, it came up, it flashed up on our computer. So you're not any way connected to this person that's on the registry? No. I bought this car 2 weeks ago. Okay, have a great day. That is the worst thing that I can ever fathom that would happen. So for a person to spend hours and hours calling everybody about an imaginary problem is beyond what I can comprehend. I would never have thought about calling my PFR registration officer to ask about selling a car. It would never have entered my mind. So.
All right, well, let's move along. I then call our state capitol and talk to the state organization that runs the registry. They tell me I can sell it all I want. But the buyer won't be able to register it with the DMV because it will come back as not clean to be sold because it's listed on the registry. So it's impossible for me to sell it because who's going to buy a car? They can't register with the DMV.
Well,
so see, I go ahead.
And there's the problem right there. You notice what she said. I called the state office that runs the registry. She didn't say I called the motor vehicle office because she wouldn't have got this answer from motor vehicles.
I'm with you there.
They could care less about that. So
I ask her in all seriousness, what do you do when someone is in custody for years? What if it was 2 years or three? There's literally no mechanism for me to sell a car with his name on it. She said again that I could sell it, but the buyer can't register it. So I can't sell it. The DMV registration on the stupid thing expires this month. I wanted to not have to smog it, which I guess is do the emissions inspection, register it and insure it. I'm stuck paying for three cars until he gets out, only one of which I'm driving.
Well, my thoughts are very clear that I think you've created a scary scenario in your head. I don't think that there's any problem here selling the car. I don't think it's that you're going to have the difficulty you think you are. We sell the car, cancel the registration with the motor vehicle department. Don't worry about the sexual offender registration office. That'll take care of itself. When he gets out, he can update all the cars when he goes in. They'll ask him, what are you driving? We have this car on file. No, I sold that. That one's gone. I don't have that one anymore. He can take care of that. But she will have no trouble selling the car, and the person will have no problem registering the car, in my opinion. If it turns out that I'm wrong, she can come on the show and she can say, you're the nuttiest fruitcake. I could not. The person bought the car, and I had to give them their money back because they couldn't register it, but I don't see a problem here. I think she's invented a problem in her head.
In chat, the biggest mistake people make is asking cops what the law is. I think that's a fair point.
It is indeed.
One other thing that I want to add. So in another comment that someone wrote on this, I've been through this in Florida, but a little bit of a different situation. I bought a new truck cash. When the salespeople were trying to register the new truck in my name, it said in big red letters on the DMV screen, truck cannot be registered because this person is a PFR and has to register in person. After several calls to my lawyer and the state and the DMV, I was finally allowed to leave with my new truck I paid cash for, only after being humiliated for several hours. That's in Florida.
Well,
I guess I said that at the beginning.
I can't speak to that, but you know, it's a courtesy and convenience to buy something from a dealer and have to register it. I actually resent that. I prefer to, when I'm at the dealership and you tell me I can't, here's what the way it irritates me. They say, well, we can't register it for you until you show us you got proof of insurance. I said, yes. Well, I don't need to prove a damn thing to you. That's a state obligation. Well, we can't register it until you show proof. I said, well, just give me my paperwork and I'll go register it myself.
Okay.
So it's all in how you look at things. I don't see a problem with that.
Gotcha. Well, I don't have anything else on anything here. Is there, we're over time already. Do you want to cover anything else before we skedaddle?
I think we've done a great job. I missed everybody for the last 2 weeks, and now we're back in business.
We are back in business, and you are roasting down there.
It's only 98 now.
Only 98. Head over to registrymatters.co to find show notes. You can leave a voicemail message at 747-227-4477. Leave email. Some people do, some people don't, at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, if you'd like to become a patron, we would so very much appreciate it. And that's at patreon.com/registrymatters. I don't have anything else, Larry. I hope you have a fantastic weekend, and I will talk to you soon. Have a great night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody in chat. Thank you guys for coming out. Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.